PA Books is a production of PCN, a nonprofit television network. Listeners like you make our programming possible. To learn more about PCN's mission and to support PCN with a donation, visit PCNTV.com. This link and others can be found in our show notes. We appreciate your support.
Welcome to the PA Books Podcast. I'm Phil Beckman. PA Books features interviews with authors of Pennsylvania history, culture, and people. In this episode, we speak with Lawrence Knorr about his book, A Saddlebag Doctor of the Mahantongo Valley of Pennsylvania.
This week on PA Books, Lawrence Knorr, author of A Saddlebag Doctor of the Mahantongo Valley of Pennsylvania.
Lawrence Knorr is the author of A Saddlebag Doctor of the Mahantongo Valley of Pennsylvania, and you write in your book about the story of Dr. Reuben Harris Moot. How did you discover him?
Wow. Yeah, that's a great question. Completely accidentally, I purchased via actually eBay a box of old books, and it said it was the books of a doctor. And I thought this will be interesting because it was in the neighborhood of where I did a lot of family history research. So bought the box, got it, opened it up. There was a lot of ephemera in it, and there were 30-some leather day books that I thought were completely useless. And this was like over 10 years ago, maybe 14 years ago. So I kind of set them aside. Then I looked at them again, and I thought, oh, maybe I can make a project out of this. And ultimately, it became the basis of my dissertation. So I discovered the doctor that way. Otherwise, he would just be a tombstone in a cemetery.
Now, when you open the day book, what do you see?
So the day books are these little, like, 5x7, maybe 4x6 leather-bound volumes, and it's sort of like a little daily planner. So you open it up, and it has the calendar for the week, and then 25 rows that you could write patients in. So he would write in his India ink the patient's name, and then what days of the week he saw them. So it was a ledger that tracked his patient visits and then how much he charged them. He would write in most of the books, he would write how much he charged them. Otherwise, a standard visit was his standard fee.
When did he live?
He lived from 1826 to 1899.
So when you look through these day books and other materials, what do you learn about a doctor from that time period?
Well, you learn on the one hand that they were very busy. Like they worked 6 or 7 days a week. And they also didn't make a whole lot of money compared to doctors today. So a traveling doctor in a rural community was really, he had to have a couple different professions if he was going to sustain his family. So that's another thing that's sort of unusual about doctors and that time frame.
Where did he grow up?
So he started out in northern Berks County in a little town called Rarersburg, and that's where he was born. He spent some time there until he went off to college. So it's northern Berks, is right on the Tuppahawken Path. He actually grew up in a home that I found out was known as the Inn at Tolheo, which was right on, I guess was the last inn on the Tuppahawken Path. It was the edge of civilization in colonial times. So I can imagine growing up there that he would have heard a lot of stories about the homestead he lived in, about Indians coming and going, and Conrad Weiser, and so on. So it was that neighborhood on the Tuppahawken Path.
What kind of an education would he have had as a child?
So we think he may have gone to a local day school, but for the most part, this was before there were the one-room schoolhouses. So I don't think that had started yet. So he was too young for that. But there was a local school. There was no records of him attending it. Otherwise, they learned in the house. They learned at church.
And you mentioned that he grew up in an inn. So were his parents innkeepers?
Actually, they weren't. So it just was a big house. So it had a lot of kids. And the family was involved in the lumber trade. So they had a very big lumber mill. It was probably the largest in the area.
So he grows up, goes off to college. He ends up in Marshall College in Mercersburg.
Yeah.
Tell us about Marshall College at that time.
Yeah, so very small institution down near the Mason-Dixon line in Mercersburg, also known as the town where eventually James Buchanan, the president, is from. And you know, interesting story there at Marshall College. I'm not sure exactly what he was studying, but he was in a preparatory school. So we don't know if he was preparing for medicine at that point or was he just going off to college. I believe that he gets the money for that when his grandfather passes away and had left some money for each of the grandchildren. So he goes there, but he doesn't graduate.
Is there information about what you possibly have studied there, like what a curriculum would have been like?
Yeah. So fortunately, there's the Marshall College catalogs, and they have in it all the teachers, the curriculum, what the students would study in any given year. So it was a very classical education of like Greek, Latin, Roman, history, language, some of the classic texts. Now, I would say that Marshall was also known as a school for ministers, so a lot of his classmates were also studying to become ministers. And he ends up in a home, because he's an older student, he ends up in a boarding house, the Hassler home, there in Mercersburg, and he's cohabitating with three future reverends and a couple other classmates. And so he's living a little bit off campus, goes to class every day, very strict school. I think they have all kinds of rules about attending church and behaving well. So,
how many records are available of his presence there?
So, the catalogs mention him, and there was a later researcher who, while the records existed, wrote about some incidents at the school. And while Muth isn't mentioned, the room that he was in was mentioned as being involved in some malfeasance. But otherwise, almost all the records are gone. They were destroyed in a fire in the 1920s. So, I mean, the quick story on what happened to him, we're not absolutely sure what happened, but for some reason, Reuben doesn't graduate from college. A couple of his other classmates don't graduate from college. And there's an anecdote about a party held at the Hassler house, students in the Hassler boarding house at the time that he was there and these others were there. Now, doing the research, I figured out who all the students were from the catalogs, and then I tracked their genealogy and figured out who they were, where they eventually lived, and what they did. And three of them are pretty well-known Reformed or Lutheran ministers. So the trouble they got into was so bad that they were expelled. And then I guess several of them asked for forgiveness, and it was granted. I'm not saying that those ministers were the ones that were involved in this party. We don't know that, but they were around this room at that time. So something happened in the room. Reuben doesn't graduate, and neither do a couple of his mates. So
they tell a story in the book about conflict between some of the town residents and some of the students over the school's stance on slavery. What happened?
Yeah, so the school is very close to the Mason-Dixon line, so there were freemen in the town, and there was an incident between students and some townspeople. At one time, it was just always some hostility or tension between them. I think it's because a number of the faculty were abolitionists, and so there was always carping back and forth, and there was a significant fight one night about the time that Reuben was there, so he would have witnessed that.
So he doesn't graduate from Marshall College, but he does later end up going to the University of Pennsylvania.
Right.
How does he make that transition?
Right. So he comes home, probably because he's out of money. He's probably in some kind of trouble. Maybe the family doesn't know what happened at school. I doubt that they do. He's an older student. I think he's about 24, 25. Fortunately, he lives in the town with a Dr. Tryon. Jacob Tryon has been a physician for a long time, and the Tryons are physicians throughout Eastern Pennsylvania, and he hooks up with the Tryon family. Jacob Tryon's son-in-law becomes his mentor and gets him started down the path of becoming a medical doctor, so which requires 3 years of apprenticeship and 2 years at a medical college. So then that would be the College of Pennsylvania, University of Pennsylvania.
Who was Samuel Treichler?
Samuel Treichler was a young man who was in Rarersburg around the same time, maybe six, seven years younger than Dr. Muth, who also got involved in the medical field, went off to the University of Pennsylvania a year earlier and had as his mentor Jacob Tryon, the doctor right there in Rarersburg. So I think because of the affiliation with the University of Pennsylvania, both of them pursuing medicine, they then become buddies. They go off to the University of Pennsylvania together in what was Treichler's second year and Dr. Moot's first year at Penn.
And he does graduate from the medical school there.
He does.
How old is he at Southport?
He's in his late 20s by the time he graduates.
And where does he go to hang his shingle out as a doctor?
Yeah, so it's peculiar too, because it's not like he goes off to the West or some big city or even back to his hometown. He goes a couple towns over to a village called Stumpstown, also known as now as Fredericksburg. And over in Jonestown, Treichler is set up as a physician. And it appears that he works for Treichler for several years, maybe 2-3 years, because in his notes, he's paying back some debts and he's buying some books. So I suspect that maybe Treichler has helped him through medical school and perhaps helped finance that. So it looks like he works for him for several years, and then he goes off on his own.
So Fredericksburg, this is in Lebanon County.
Yes.
What is life like there for him? He's now settling in. He's starting his own practice. Does he start a family?
Yeah, so fortunately, we have a description of him from a gentleman, Ezra Grumbine, who is a doctor himself and a historian of Pennsylvania Dutch culture. And he wrote a book about Old Stumpstown, of all things, and describes Dr. Moot as a very mild-mannered, meek man with a red beard, well-cropped. And so I always pictured him as somewhat of an introvert. And Stumpstown, even today, Fredericksburg is a very small town. I think the biggest thing there now is a chicken plant. So he's there at a time when he's got Treichler a few miles to the west and a Dr. Beaver who's already well established in the town. And he really struggles to make a living there. He meets a young lady of the Hauer family, and he ends up marrying her. She's only 17 years old, and unfortunately has consumption right around the time that he meets her. She's either already sick or becomes sick shortly after and doesn't live much longer.
How long does he stay in Fredericksburg?
He stays in Fredericksburg. He's there about 5 years, and right around 1860, he leaves. So it's after his wife passes away in 1858. He spends a little bit longer there, and then he heads up northwest into over the hill.
And so his next move is more permanent,
yes,
right? I mean, he does end up staying there for most of the rest of his life. What town is he in, and how does he establish himself?
Yeah, so he next heads up to what was known as Mahanoy, or Red Cross, Pennsylvania. I always thought it was interesting that the doctor moves to Red Cross and Red Cross becomes this big medical thing, but that was not the case back then. In fact, it wasn't called Red Cross then. But I was uncertain why he chose that town, but following the Tryon family, there was a doctor very nearby in the little town of Reebok, Michael Tryon, who was retiring. So Jacob connects, I think, Dr. Moot to Michael Tryon, his cousin, and suggests he goes up that way. Now, it also turns out that one of the families in the area that's very prominent is related to the Schneider family, which is his mother's family, Dr. Moot's mother's family. So there might have been some talk that up that way there's other kinfolk that he could associate with. So he heads about 40, 50 miles northwest up the Susquehanna River into the Mocotongo Valley, and settles there at what is now Red Cross.
We'll be back in a moment with the PA Books podcast.
Enjoying this podcast? Please support PCN with a donation at pcntv.com. This link and others can be found in our show notes. We appreciate your support.
Now, since this is his longtime residence, I presume most of the day books are talking about his daily activities in this area.
Yeah.
So what is life like for a doctor in a small town in a rural area, probably traveling to different farms?
Yeah, so his practice builds slowly. He only sees a couple patients a day, so it's a pretty slow go, but he's a traveling physician, so he's getting out on his horse with his saddlebags, or ultimately he has a carriage later on, I guess when the roads are a little better. But he starts out as a saddlebag doctor. So he's got to get up in the morning, get his sustenance, put his horse together, get his gear on the horse, and head out. How he finds his appointments, not exactly sure. Somebody's probably running to the house, maybe a telegram, something like that. Or he's doing his rounds, and he's riding out one road in a circuit, and people will call for him as he goes by.
Are there any visits in the daybook that really stand out for you?
Well, there are several. One early in his stay in the new community, he runs into a patient, Louisa Deppin, who happens to be the daughter of the richest man in the area. And he sees her as a patient several times. And normally when he notes in the book about his patients, he mentions the household, the head of household, like would be the father's name. He mentions her individually a couple times. And she ends up becoming his wife not long after. So that one really stands out. There's other, anytime there's a birth, which he labeled with an O, an obstetric visit, you know, I was able to look up the family and see, was there a child born at that time? Who was the child? And you could look at mortality records and figure that out. That was always interesting. There was another gentleman who he noted had committed suicide. And that was very troubling to see that he had a patient who he had seen the day before. And then that man kills himself. And I could just tell from the way the notations were made that this was something that shocked him. When going through his books, the list of books, I was able to purchase a bunch of those books, not his books, but copies of them. And there was a book on mental health that he had that was very stunning for the time, the things that they believed and how they treated things. But essentially, the melancholy that this man had when he committed suicide was untreatable, according to the books that Dr. Moot had. So he probably felt there was nothing he could do but maybe talk to the guy. And unfortunately, he offed himself.
What kind of services would a traveling doctor have performed?
So probably the most important one were the obstetric visits. And he helped the birth of almost 900 human beings in his career. So that was a good part of it. That definitely led to more success with that kind of service. Childbirth was a very risky thing for the mother, especially, and many infants didn't survive. So better numbers, better results by having a trained physician involved with that. But, you know, most of his visits were probably more like psychological, knowing what, if this was really before they knew about antibiotics and how to treat a lot of diseases. He seemed to be a fairly skilled surgeon, pretty good at that stuff, setting broken bones, you know, the basics of that kind of healthcare. But when it came to treating illnesses, you know, it was just, you know, what they did at that time.
Now, was this an area where there was extensive Pennsylvania Dutch culture?
Absolutely. And so he was a Pennsylvania Dutch speaker. His family were definitely that. You can tell from the tombstones of his parents, also some notations in his book, some things that he kept. So. Absolutely. Almost all the patients that he saw had German names and were of the Pennsylvania Dutch culture, and that valley is well known for that culture even to this day. So.
And were there any specific cultural attitudes towards medicine that he would have encountered?
Well, I think a lot of places, doctors had developed reputations, especially early on with bleeding people and that kind of treatment. Well, he wasn't trained with that, so he's of the class of doctor now that they're letting go of the leeches and the bleeding and that kind of gross stuff. But there was, many in the Civil War camps, they would joke that they were better off not being treated by a doctor. So there's a lot of suspicion that this medical trade really wasn't all that fruitful. And he was right at a time when they were trying to make it a profession. So it had gone from more of an art to a profession with this formal training at a university.
Now, during that time period, Pennsylvania passed a law requiring the registration of doctors. How did that impact him? Does he show up in the records?
He does. And of course, with his education at the university, he flies right through that. But many doctors across Pennsylvania run into trouble with that. So they don't have the formal education. Now, some of them are grandfathered in if they've been practicing for so long and have proven to be successful. But yeah, it was a standard around education requirements I think in the 1870s.
Now you mentioned his second wife, Louisa Deppin. Did they have children?
Yes, they had one child, a son. And, you know, it's interesting that here he is living with Louisa all these years and they only have one child. Maybe it's because he's always out and about the countryside, riding around in his buggy, treating people. But yeah, he does have one child, one son.
What does his son grow up to do?
Well, his son grows up to cause his father a lot of worry when he's young. And I think the one thing that was unusual about the journals is the doctors noting when the son is gone for a prolonged period of time, like maybe overnight or several days, and he doesn't know what the son's doing, and he's noting that he's away. So he's worried about him, and he's probably worried that he's getting into trouble, maybe like he did back at Marshall College or something like that. We don't know. But the son, he gets involved in more mechanical profession, more like a pipe fitter and things like that around the area. He doesn't really have to do much because he's the grandson of the great Deppin, you know, of the area, and a very well-to-do family. So.
Now he also gets involved in farming at some point. Is it a transition, or does he continue to practice medicine throughout his life and he's running a farm?
Yeah, he does both. In fact, he does a lot of livestock farming. So he notes that, and every year he notes the cow that's killed or the bull that's killed around Christmas time. I guess they fashioned their beef for the year. He also did have a garden, and he did grow fruit trees. There's mention of different trees and things that he had planted. So he was trying to be a good homeowner, and I'd say a modest farmer. He wasn't a great farmer. He didn't have a lot of land. He was not one of the biggest farmers around, but definitely engaged in that, and probably more so to feed his family.
What was his role in the community? Was he a prominent figure?
Yes, he was. Yeah, he was beyond being just the doctor, and he was one of a couple doctors in the area. He was also involved in a horse thief insurance agency that he helped to start.
And this was called the Jackson Horse Detective Company?
Yes. So he was a horse detective. And I think there were two claims in the whole time. One time they had to go all the way to Philadelphia, and they were able to recover the horse. And there were reports in the newspapers about the horse company and how much money they had in the treasury and who the officers were. So he was part of that. He also became a treasurer at the local Lutheran church for several years.
So when you look back at his life in this community as a doctor, what do you learn about that? Is he, you mentioned you focus on his class status, middle class doctor. It was not necessarily a path to riches.
Right. Yeah, I think he loved living up in the valley, up in the hills. I think he loved his farm. I think he loved circulating among the people, even though he did seem to be a bit introverted. Not so sure he loved his home life all that much. There's not a lot of evidence of that. Unfortunately, we don't have a diary or letters for him between other people, or love letters between he and Louisa. That doesn't exist. But from all the evidence, he seems to be a very prominent member of the community, just a regular stalwart kind of guy, very much towards the end of his life involved in his church.
How far would he travel in a day? When you read the records in the day book, does it give a sense of the distances and the range he would have been working in?
Yeah, so sometimes he would go usually about 20, 25 miles in a day. So you think about 3 miles an hour times eight, that's about right. There was a train that would go from Red Cross up to Shamokin and to other towns like Sunbury and over into the coal regions. It seems like sometimes he must have done that because he'd see some patients that were Deppin family members that were in other towns. But unless they were coming to visit, he had to have done something like that.
Is there a sense of how his practice changed over time? Certainly as he's getting older, he's probably not gonna want to be out riding a horse in the wintertime going places. Did it change as he got older?
Yeah, so he kind of goes through a cycle where his practice really builds, and then his mother passes away, around 1876, he takes a break for almost a year, not sure what he does. You know, there's a big exposition in Philadelphia. He could have gone to that. Maybe he's just resetting. Rebuilds his practice, and it seems towards the end, he's seeing people more in at his office. And there's still to this day anecdotes about Dr. Moot's office. And there's apparently there's a gate I have yet to see that has a sign above it, Dr. Moot. So people would come to him. So yeah, once he got into his late 60s, early 70s, they had to come see him.
Were you able to track down where he's buried?
Yes, he's buried at the Lutheran Church in Red Cross, Pennsylvania. I've been to his grave a few times.
Is there any other artifacts or items related to him that survive in the community?
You know, I've heard that there are family members that have some things. There was a great auction back in the early 60s where a lot of stuff was sold. For some reason, the people just don't want to talk about it or don't want to share it. I do have a lead right now that there is somebody that might actually have a photograph, because sadly, I don't have any family pictures. And doing this research and trying to rebuild his life without a photograph of him was disappointing, but I did the best I could.
When did he die, and what do we know about how he died?
Yeah, so it looks like he probably died from influenza, a pneumonia, and it was in 1899. There was an article in the local newspaper that say doctors do die, or doctors die too. And it listed the well-known Dr. Muth of Red Cross, Mahanoy, Pennsylvania, and that he had succumbed.
Would he have been considered a success in his community?
I would say so. Now, if you would ask doctors in the big cities and maybe some of his peers, like I did an analysis of his income versus some of the other people in his life that were doctors, and he ranked near the bottom for the money he made as a doctor, but we don't know how many lives did he impact. He helped give birth to 900 people, so that's a great impact. So maybe it's more around the acts of grace and good work that he's done, that he had an impact. You know, he also helped build his church, which still exists to this day. And so I, you know, it's one of these things. How do you analyze somebody who's a virtual unknown, and you kind of cook them up out of all this forensic information? I wished I could sit and talk to him in person and ask him that very question.
We've been speaking with Lawrence Knorr. He is the author of A Saddlebag Doctor of the Mahantongo Valley of Pennsylvania. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
Listeners like you make PCN programming possible. Full episodes of PA Books, as well as other PCN programs, are available to stream with the PCN Select app. To learn more about PCN's mission and to support PCN with a donation, visit PCNTV.com. This link and others can be found in our show notes. We appreciate your support.